Welcome, everyone, to the first general session of our spring convention of the California Council of the Blind here in Burlingame. Let's give a huge clap and applause. We have our wonderful streaming team in the back. As of this morning, not only did we have people listening from our state of California, we also had Arizona listening in. We had Florida listening in. So we are definitely being heard around the world. So before we get started, if you want a door prize, might I have you all say a big, healthy hello to ACB Radio World.
Hello, ACB Radio World.
Wonderful. That was a good one. Okay. Before we get started, I would like to go ahead and we shall do a quick door prize before we get into our program. And he has his roller skates on. And let's see, he has... We have a T-shirt from the Yosemite Gateway Chapter.
Margaret is here if they want to change the size.
And Margaret is here if someone needs to change shirt size. So what does the shirt say?
Yosemite Gateway Chapter. David Hunter?
David Hunter. Is David Hunter in the room? No, David. Ruby Edger? Edgar. Is Ruby here? Nope. Let's do another one.
Have to be present to win.
There we go.
Julie Ogeneku? Joy Ogeneku.
It's colored your size.
Valerie Reese Lerman. Valerie, are you here? Not yet. Uh-oh. I bet everybody's in the exhibit hall. Catherine Skivers. Is Kathy Skivers here? Yay! Ed!
Yes.
She's to your left.
Oh. Hi, Kathy. She said a big hello. And she wants to know what color it is, so I'm sure I saw dark, so it might be black. Oh, it's navy blue. Ah, very nice. It'll match her jeans. Okay, let us go ahead and we will start with our invocation. We have Betsy Woodward, and she is Minister of Christian Education at the Congregational Church of San Mateo. I might give it over to you to do our invocation, please.
Greetings. I'm so glad to be here. I'm honored to be in a group of people that are working so hard for the Council of the Blind. I know it's very important work. We have two guide dogs at our church, plus a lot of other people that are very supportive, and I'm so glad that you're here, and I hear you have 21 committees. I think that's really wonderful. So let's begin, and let's have a prayer together. God of creation, we give you thanks for the many times we've been startled by the world's beauty, for the selfless love we have found in others, for the people of courage who bring changes in our world, for the new ideas from this conference that will bring us hope, for the circle of friends that surround each of us with love, for all the blessings of food that nourish our bodies every day. Amen.
Okay, and if we could please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. And there is no flag in the room. We will be having the colors presented tomorrow.
We will pretend it.
And Roger says the flag is in our hearts. Our wise second vice president. Okay. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. You may be seated. We have our Welcome to Burlingame by Susie Castoria, and she is president of the San Mateo County Commission on Disabilities. If I might give the microphone over.
Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me here today. I'm going to welcome you to San Mateo County. I'm actually part of the county and not part of the city of Burlingame, so I don't want to make you think differently. Yesterday, I went on the council's website. I was really impressed, and I think they're working you way too hard at this conference. My goodness. But I think that the Commission on Disabilities has some similarities. The only big difference is there's only 15 of us total. But it's awfully good to be able to address the California Council of the Blind and let you know what the commission is doing. We've celebrated our 20th anniversary last summer, and we've been very active in the county for the full 20 years. We are appointed and supported by the San Mateo Board of Supervisors, and we've been charged with keeping them informed of the needs and concerns of the disability community. This is no small task. If you think of the types of disabilities there are, we're a group that spans all ages, all races, and all economic levels. Think of the people that you know in this room. It's pretty clear that vision impairment can touch anyone, and that's true for almost every disability. The commission is made up of volunteers who are passionate about making changes to improve the livability of San Mateo County. So what are we doing? Well, like the CCB, we try to influence change and advocate for our community. The Commission on Disabilities has 5 standing committees. We have an executive, a youth and family, a special events, an ADA compliance committee, and a legislation advocacy committee. I know compared to your 21, that's hardly a drop in the bucket. But we also have ad hoc committees that work for things that don't necessarily fall into a standing committee role. So we have an emergency preparedness group that works very closely with the county's Office of Emergency Services. We have a number of our group have attended FAST training. I don't know if you're aware of what that is, but it's functional assessment service teams. And in an emergency, a FAST member would be on site of an emergency shelter to help coordinate the needs of people with disabilities. So if you and your guide dog showed up to an emergency shelter and someone said, oh, you can't have an animal in here, the FAST member would make sure that you and the dog got exactly what you needed through talking to the shelter staff and the people who are running it. Or if someone needs a hospital-type bed to stay in an emergency shelter, we would be the people that would assess that and help it be gotten for you. We also take part in the San Mateo County Fair's Emergency Preparedness Day, which you might know is the first day of the fair every year. And if you come by 10 a.m., you get into the fair free. So keep that in mind. It's coming up, I think it's June 9th this year. And you can walk through all the displays of emergency preparedness and then go get your hot dogs and ride the Ferris wheels. Another group that is an ad hoc committee is one that works with the elections office and make sure that all of our polling places are accessible and that the new e-slates are available in all of the precincts. Have any of you tried the new e-slates? It's called an e-slate. It's an electronic voting slate that has headphones for you. Yes. Oh, okay. And you were successful in doing that? It worked out well? Oh, good. That's good to hear. Back to our committees. San Mateo County is absolutely committed to accessibility. And towards that goal, we have an ADA compliance committee that looks at every county-owned, rented, or leased building, including the facilities available in our parks. Last year, we were able to upgrade two playgrounds to include climbing structures and trails that are now wheelchair accessible. We also had to appear before the California Coastal Commission to successfully argue that a mixed-use trail at Fitzgerald Marine Reserve needed to be 8 foot wide to accommodate everyone. In September, we held a symposium that focused on the changes to the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act. There was an upgrade during 2010 that became effective 2011 that changed a number of building codes. And so we invited all the local governments, and we had 14 cities out of 20 in the county attend and be involved. We had scheduled Jessely Lorenz. I don't know if anybody's familiar with her. Oh, good. to speak on programmatic access, but she was sick that day, so Rick Halloran filled in for her. And Rick is a San Francisco building inspector who, with Jesse, had templates made so that when he's checking Braille, it actually says what it's supposed to. So that San Francisco City building inspectors check the Braille when they inspect a building, which I think is... Yeah, Jesse says she's found signs that instead of saying elevator up, says something else. So Rick's worked very closely with her to be sure that the Braille's appropriate. But I've got to tell you that the most popular handout was the Department of Justice's revised regulations regarding service animals. More people were interested in what is truly a service animal and what are their rights than almost anything else we presented that day. We have a special events committee that's very busy because anytime we put on any event, the special events committee has to work on it. But we also celebrated, like I said, our 20th anniversary. We had a classic car show and a disability awareness fair. We have a signature event every October, which is called the Art Showcase. And it showcases artists with disabilities open to any artist in San Mateo County. We've been doing it for 20 years, 21 years, I think. It had to only be 20, huh? But we show the art for the full month of October, which is Disabilities Awareness Month. And then the last night, we have a silent auction and a reception and sell the art. And it allows artists who aren't normally recognized to actually get paid and sell and be paid for some of their artwork. Last year, I believe we sold all but four pieces. This year, the art's going to hang in the Hall of Justice at County Center in Redwood City. So if in October you want to walk through it, it'll be available. This year, we're also doing awareness events. Starting Monday, I'm working with 900 students at Half Moon Bay High. They invited us for an entire week of disability awareness training. I don't know about 900 high school students, I got to tell you. That one's a little shaky. Very, very scary. And first class starts at 6:40 in the morning. I'm going to think I'm here at this convention, aren't I? On the 26th of this month, we're having a, together with Legal Aid, we're having an advocacy training for parents of children with disabilities on how to maneuver through the individual education plan process. The IEP is so important that you get your child started and you're working with the school system rather than against it to get the education they deserve. And so many parents don't know how to maneuver it. That Legal Aid has been very good in sponsoring this event with us. This will be our second one. and we do it in English and Spanish. And this year we will be speaking to approximately 100 families. So that's another big event. In July, we're going to hold an awareness fair at County Center for county employees. We really feel that educating the county employee to the needs of the disability community allows outreach throughout the county in every aspect, and we're really hoping this one goes well. We're going to use the opening of the Olympics as our theme, and we're going to have the departments compete against each other for awards and medals. It's going to be fascinating. In September, the Golden State Rods Car Club is holding a classic car club for us for a fundraiser. And we're going to be holding another symposium in late September, which will focus on small business owners' needs of understanding of the ADA. So what do they need to know to open a small business and basically avoid being sued for mistakes that are avoidable? And I have 1 minute. In October, we'll have our art show again. And I think the thing that's really important is the Commission on Disabilities is successful because of the passion of its commissioners. We are all volunteer. We have a blind commissioner who in September will be celebrating her 98th birthday.
Oh, my.
Aww. She is on three committees and attends all the meetings and keeps us in line. She is amazing. But education and outreach are our primary goal, and if anybody is interested in the commission, Jean knows how to get a hold of me, and I would look forward to having you at any of our meetings. Thank you very much.
Wow, they're busy, aren't they? I would like to invite someone up here to say a few words who definitely is a, and this is not in the program, this is a very nice surprise, someone who is definitely a member of our family and someone that we definitely know and love, who we gave an award to last year. I would like to invite Dr. Stuart Wittenstein, Superintendent of California School for the Blind, to come and say a few words.
Hi, everybody, and thank you, President Donna Pomerantz, for squeezing me into the program here for a few minutes, and thank you for that very warm welcome. I definitely feel like a member of the family when I'm here with CCB, which is wonderful. Unfortunately, last year I couldn't be with you last May in Sacramento to receive a great honor from you. And my wife and I are both fortunate that we still have our moms, and they're in their 90s. And when mom needs you, I mean, she was always there when we needed her. So it's important for us to be there for her now. And so I wasn't able to make it last time. But I did want to say a few words of thanks for the CCB Humanitarian Award. On the plaque, it said some really nice things about me that I hope to try to continue to live up to for a while. It said I was an advocate for education and for use and teaching of Braille, and for giving students opportunities to engage in real-world work experience and to preserve the specialized school as part of the continuum of our education system. And, we don't always achieve all of our goals, but we certainly strive to. One of my favorite people to quote was the manager of the New York Yankees when I was growing up in New York, Casey Stengel. And he always said, the Yankees don't pay me to win every game, just 2 out of 3. So when I do 2 out of 3, I feel like I'm doing pretty well. But I really wanted to tell you that there's really nothing more gratifying to me than a recognition by blind individuals, by the organized blind, for the work that I've had the privilege and honor to do for now I'm in my 39th year of doing this, 16 at California School for the Blind. And we form a team here And I'm watching the clock, Donna, because I know you squeezed me in here. Though Al Gill told me I could talk for as long as I wanted, but luckily Al isn't running the meeting for those. just this week, members of CCB were at a legislative hearing speaking on behalf of the California School for the Blind, because as you know, our state budget's in trouble. And school districts and public education have been hurt by budget cuts. And actually, CSB has been spared for some of the worst of that. Well, it's our turn now. And we were cut last year. We're anticipating another cut this year. And members of CCB were there on Tuesday speaking to the Assembly's Fiscal Committee to explain why our services are so valued and so needed, not only by the kids who are enrolled at our school, but by kids who we support so that they can stay in their local schools and get good services in their local school districts through our outreach services. So I want to thank particularly Jeff Tom, who coordinated all of this for us, and of course Joni Patchy, who's been chair of our community advisory committee and an outspoken proponent of the school for us. And I actually have so much CCB representation on our community advisory committee that if I started naming them, I'd probably leave somebody out. You guys have been wonderful advisors to me throughout my years at the California School for the Blind, starting with Kathy Skivers, who was on the community advisory committee when we started it back in 96, 97. We really count on your support and appreciate it, and we know that we have a team that we've built here. I wanted to mention just one more thing before I get off, because I know I'm probably taking time away from Joe. Sorry, Joe. One of the things you may not know about is that professional educators and rehabilitators have a Blindness Hall of Fame, Leaders and Legends of the Blindness Field. And I was at a presentation last October at the American Printing House for the Blind, and I realized when I was looking through the list of inductees that Dr. Newell Perry isn't among them. And I thought, wow, that's an oversight that we need to correct. So with Donna's help and Jeff's help and Kathy Skivers, who wrote an amazing letter of support, we've submitted a nomination for Dr. Perry that's being considered right now. And for those of you who may know the name but don't know the man, it's an incredible story of advocacy. Back in the late 1800s. He formed the first CSB Alumni Association, and he founded this organization in 1934 and was its first president for 20 years. Dr. Perry believed that well-meaning sighted folks like me wouldn't know how to set an agenda for blind people. Blind people needed to set the agenda for blind people. And so he started us on the road, and he would be so proud to see this group today, to see this turnout, to see how active that this organization is in advocating for the needs of blind people. So we haven't heard yet from the committee. We expect to hear within the next month or so whether or not Dr. Perry's nomination has been accepted. And if it is, he'll be inducted into the Hall of Fame in October. And I'll keep Donna and Jeff and Kathy informed of our progress as it goes. But very excited to learn more about Dr. Perry and to put together the nomination package. So this organization, you've got a lot to be proud of. You have a wonderful history and you have a wonderful future. And thank you so much again for recognizing me with your humanitarian award.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wittenstein. Next, we will be hearing from the Department of Rehabilitation. We'll be getting an update from Joe Xavier, Deputy Director, Specialized Services Division, Department of Rehabilitation, Sacramento, California. And before I give it over to Joe, I would like to, we have Director Sauer here as well. It's a pleasant surprise, and I'd like to have you say a few words before we give it over to Joe, and thank you so much for coming and spending some time with us today.
Okay, thank you, Donna, and thank you for welcoming me. Is this okay? Can you hear me in the back? Not really.
I'm going to grab Joe's here.
How about that one? Is that one's better? Okay. So thank you for welcoming me, and I don't get to come to all of your meetings, but when I do, it's always a pleasure, and a pleasure seeing a lot of faces. And thanks, Donna, for giving us the 3 hours you're going to give us for all the things we have to cover. Joe and I have a lot to talk about, but, you know, specifically our department, as you're hearing from many folks, and you will today and tomorrow, it's difficult times in government. It's a difficult times in human services, and we have been able to fare pretty well during this very tough time. Our budget's hovering around $420 million. We're still serving about 115,000 people. It's down a few thousand from previous years, but not drastically down. And last year, we were able to successfully help with 11,600 folks go to work, which was up around 900 from the year before. And that's an important number for us, because every one of those people is living independently and living with dignity in their communities and working and providing income for themselves. So I really appreciate that. Joe has got a lot of words to say, and I will jump in here from time to time. I know we are limited for time, so it's good to see all of you, and I'm glad, as the others have said, that you're all here together, and through this community you can do so much, and as we work with other communities, we can really help continue to change the world. So here's Joe.
Well, thank you all for, and thank you, Donna, for inviting us here to present to you. Sorry, we're trying to get this mic situation. You know, this is really tough. We come on after lunch, we're competing with exhibits, and the opening day of the Giants? Yeah. Oh, come on. Okay, we got to do it. So, no, I'm okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ed, for freeing up the court. I felt like I was tied down. First of all, we'd like to recognize a number of our staff that are here in the room, because they're the people that are on the front lines doing the work every day to get the 11,600 people jobs that Tony referred to. And we have a number of our supervisors, some of our counseling staff here, and other staff from the Department of Rehab. So a big thank you to you. And one of the things that you may not all know is that March 22nd is the National Rehabilitation Counselors Day, which is a very important day. Both Tony and I were the beneficiary of services, as I'm sure are many of you, from rehab counselors. So we know the impact that they had on our lives. And so we're forever grateful for that. And in honor of those counselors that made a difference in our lives, we acknowledge all of the counselors in our ranks, all the supervisors and all the staff that provide the everyday services. So when Gene asked for me to come here, and Tony's schedule is always a bit tenuous, so I'm very glad he was able to join us, he asked us to speak about three or four different topics. One is the vocational rehabilitation service delivery model, the new software, case management software program, OCB, and the fall resolutions. And of course, we can speak to you about a dozen other topics: budget, staffing, budget letters, state price schedule, many, many other topics that we have. But if Donna doesn't give us 3 hours, we'll never get through all of it. So we'll start with the topics you requested. And I'm sure you guys want some questions and answers, and then we can go on from there. So first thing up here is the my shameless but famous plug for jobs. And it starts with making sure that every single one of you know of the exams that the state of California has that are available to anybody who is qualified. You do not need to be a civil servant to take these exams. They are online. You can take them from your homes, wherever you can get to a computer. And they are support services assistant, staff services analyst, associate government program analyst, the QRP, the Qualified Rehab Professional Classifications, the staff services managers 1 and 2, and now the rehabilitation supervisors exams. Those are all exams that are available online. A number of those are open, so I encourage you, if you're looking for jobs, to avail yourselves of that opportunity. And this is very important, because whenever we have an opportunity to hire individuals who are blind and visually impaired, we're certainly looking to do so. But you must be eligible to be hired. That means you got to take the test, you got to do well, you got to look out for the announcements, you got to submit your application, you got to get, you know, invited to an interview, and you got to be prepared to do the job. So keep looking, keep preparing, and take those exams. So let's talk a little bit about the vocational rehabilitation service delivery model that we have been piloting for the last 6 months, and I'm going to turn this back over to Tony to speak on that topic.
Thanks, Joe. The model that our department has been using is nearly five decades old, since the department started in 1963. And we took it upon ourselves in this changing environment to look at a mechanism, a way of improving the way we deliver services. And with that, we set up 16 pilots around the state. A lot of groundwork went in before the pilots were set up. But we set up a teamed approach to rehabilitation counseling. And I think back on the days when I was a consumer over 34 years ago. It was a small office with a counselor and a support person, an office technician. And when I needed services, if my counselor wasn't in, the OT could help me. And she did many times. And sometimes it was simply getting my travel reimbursement taken care of or a tuition forwarded or whatever I needed. And then she would work with the counselor to deliver those services. What happened typically, though, in our department is we had silos of counselors and support staff in different realms. And if the counselor was on vacation or out of the office, the phone wouldn't be answered, and it might be the next day or sometimes a week or two if they're on vacation before they could get back to a consumer. So one of the many things that we're hoping to accomplish with our new model is the teamed approach. So if the counselor's not there, another counselor will know enough about that person to step in and resolve the issues until the counselor gets back and can take care of the bigger needs. The other thing that triggered this modernization was the Rehab Act Amendments of 92, which required that only qualified rehab professionals, being counselors with master's degree in counseling, could do the five non-delegable functions. And that then put a couple hundred of our counselors in jeopardy of not being able to do the counseling that they'd been doing. And those functions are determine eligibility, they determine the level of severity of disability, they approve the plan, they approve plan amendments, and they also approve plan closure. So those without the master's degree can't do those five functions. And this teamed approach still allows us for those folks to continue working for our department, because many of them are wonderful counselors and wonderful support people, and to move forward with the job that they've been doing for sometimes two and three decades, sometimes longer. The team concept also puts the consumer at the center of the focus. And I look at my doctor's office. 20 years ago when I started with this doctor, I pretty much would see the doctor or a nurse. And if I needed something, it would take sometimes two or three days to get in to see them, sometimes longer. Now they have gone to a consumer focus, a patient focus probably is what they call it. And if I call in, many times, rarely do I ever talk to the doctor. I don't need to. My needs aren't that severe. If I do need the doctor, I can see him because he's been able to delegate a lot of the work to the nurse, the physician's assistant, and sometimes even the secretary of the office knows my situation and can order a lab order without me even going to the nurse. So they've changed their focus to serve more patients because they've had to, because their billings have been reduced and they have to do more with less. And this is a similar approach where we're looking at the consumer as the focus. A typical team, if we had such thing as an ideal team, would be composed of six qualified rehab professionals, two service coordinators, one employment coordinator, and two office technicians, a general office technicians, and then, of course, the rehabilitation supervisor. Now, if that would be an ideal world where we had the exact number of people in every office that would work, we don't. We have this spread all over the state. Particularly with our blind field services, it's a lot of this is done virtually. And the pilots, we've set up 16 pilots. A couple of those are half teams, and we've collected most of the data, and we're gathering the data that ended at the end of March. And now we're looking at what were the best practices, what's working, what's not working. And regarding our blind field services pilot, Carol and her team have done a significant amount of work, and in a difficult environment with the geographical concerns being all over the state, And again, we're learning from it. We will make changes. Our goal is to roll the statewide model out early next year. We were shooting for Jan 1, but I'm not sure that's going to happen. Hopefully, it'll be early in the next calendar year. And some of the benefits of it are increased staff interaction, resulting in more responsiveness to consumers, increased shared responsibility, cases are more readily staffed, and the silos we once had are replaced with a cross-team coordination. And the most important thing is that consumers are reporting increased satisfaction. And anecdotally, we're hearing from a lot of consumers that say they've never felt so much support, because when their counselor isn't there, they still get their needs met, which I think is critical. And that was important for me 3 decades ago, and probably for Joe as well, and for many of you in this room. And the addition of team members also gets that cross-training. There's a lot more communication going on. So that is kind of our VR modernization. We really have tried to be transparent and share as much information as we could, and we weren't able to early on like we wanted to because of issues around unions. When you have unions, you can't share too much information until the union's involved. But I think as we rolled out information, staff are now up to speed of what's going on. And it's not without issues. We're going to have bumps in the road. But overall, it's a little new way of doing business. But primarily, it keeps that very critical, important relationship between the counselor and the consumer solid and strong, and it gives the counselor more support. The next item I want to talk about before I turn it back over to Joe is our status update on our AWARE. AWARE is our new consumer database system. Our department, up until last year, earlier this year actually, had been using a mainframe system that was developed in the 80s and rolled out in the early 90s, and it's an old, cumbersome system, and about 18 or 19 states before us have been using this product called AWARE. The company that developed it is out of Washington State, called Alliance, and we have rolled it out, but it's not been without glitches. The good thing is, from a fiscal perspective, we finished under budget and only 2 weeks late, which is unheard of for a state IT project. Most of them here have never get implemented. Many that do are in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And this program did roll out on time, relatively on time, and under budget. So we were excited about that. But it also, we're with our IT needs, we have a lot of staff with significant disabilities, with hearing impairments, with visual impairments, blind. And many of those folks use AT to do their work. And I've been very happy that Alliance, the company who created this product, has been working with us to work out glitches and bugs. And they have been relatively few. When there are glitches, we try to work on it. The most pushback we're getting is from staff who are sighted, frankly, who are having a hard time where the old system, they knew all the shortcuts. After 20 years, you know how to print something quickly. You know how to get from screen to screen with just a couple of keystrokes. Now you have to use your mouse a lot, and those who don't know the shortcuts using screen readers, they're getting sore wrists and having carpal tunnel issues because they're having to use their mouse a lot more. We're hoping as they get more use of the product and they learn the shortcuts that'll diminish, and they can figure out you don't have to do five clicks to print a page or go back and forth, because those are built into it. We just haven't got familiar enough with it yet. And I wanted to, this note here, to thank Tricia and Grace for their continued leadership with AWARE, particularly their blind field services. And I think, you know, it's, to quote Joe, who probably quote himself later, you know, everybody said our old system was bad and cumbersome and old, and they wanted something new. The problem is there's change involved, and whenever there's change, people don't like it. We all want to do something different, but we don't want to. We all want new things, but we don't want to change and change the way we do things. And I really messed up your quote there, Joe. Sorry. He does a lot better job with it. But as staff get more and more comfortable, and those who have been using it and they were on the pilots, they're feeling it was the right thing to do, and it is the wave of the future. Particularly the newer counselors coming in, they're the young folks. They are used to having graphic interface. They know how to maneuver through screens much quicker. So for them, it's seamless. They love it. It's just the ones who are used to the old system that are struggling a bit, and we do hope it'll not impact our consumer services. So as Joe said, we'll be here for questions. I'm going to let Joe now talk about OCB.
Thank you.
So the quote that Tony refers to, as we go out and talk to staff and all these things that are coming, we always hear, you know, all the issues would change. So the quote that I started using was that I welcome all the changes you can give me as long as I can keep doing the same thing. So let's talk about Orientation Center for the Blind. First of all, the renovation that we thought would never end, phew, finally has come to an end. The elevator has been put in, and those of you who are familiar with the campus, when you have an opportunity to go back and visit, you will not recognize it. The buildings are in the same place. They're the same structures, but it's the finishes, the interiors, the exteriors, you have a very different look and a very different feel to it. It feels much more comfortable, much more warm. So when you're in the neighborhood, I encourage you to stop by and take a look. In fact, on May 8th, we will be having an open house for OCB. Now, part of that open house will also be one of our forums to provide the opportunity for the community to give us input into our strategic planning. And those announcements have gone out, but if you are in the neighborhood and visiting, we welcome you to stop by. The OCB administrator, as a number of you know, we have had acting administrators for a couple of years now, since December of 2010. Warren Hayes helped us out, really bail us out of a very difficult situation in the 2011 timeframe, because not only was he the acting administrator, but he was also leading this renovation. And if any of you have done any remodeling in your homes, think of this as 100 times that, with control agencies and inspectors and on and on and on. So he's just has done an amazing job with that. Because he's a retired annuitant, he ran out of hours to continue to assist us as much as he needed to. So we have brought Henry Lang, who is a retired former DOR district administrator, who, while not familiar with OCB, was certainly very familiar with the administrative functions and the leadership around labor and infrastructure and all the things that needed to be done there. So he has been serving us in that capacity. And most importantly is that this past September, we were able to hire Rosa Gomez, who was sitting in the back of the row, I think the third chair in. Rosa, wave. And Rosa is well-deserved. Rosa is a former rehab counselor who worked with Tricia Leach's unit, and we're very, very glad to have Rosa on board. She's hit the ground running, 1,000 ideas, but is taking the right time to observe, absorb, and pace herself, because as she's recognizing, there's a lot to be done. One of the things that we asked Warren to do, he didn't have enough to do with the renovation and being an administrator, so we asked him to work with staff to at least put on paper what the program was at OCB, and then to start looking at what the program could be with all the changes that we were making. We added, for example, a computer lab. We added single occupancy rooms, which provide for a transition and independent living transition, and a number of other activities. And we took that curriculum, we sent it out to the community last August. We asked the community, provided a number of forums for the community to provide input. We incorporated the input, appropriate input, into the curriculum and sent it back out. Now, we have already began the second phase, because we were very clear that that was the first step and by no means the last step. So we have embarked on a strategic plan. Now, I could take 3 hours to talk about all these other topics and about 3 days to talk about strategic planning, but I think Donna would give me the hook. So let me give you the abbreviated version of strategic planning. It is simply identifying where do you want to end up, and then the strategic plan is truly the roadmap to get us there. So for OCB, we've established the vision, and then we're asking 3 questions. What is it that we are not doing that we need to do to achieve that vision? What is it that we are doing that does not contribute to getting to the vision? What is it that we are doing that we need to do much better in order to achieve that vision? We're providing a number of forums for those questions to be spoken to. The first forum was with our staff. We have a forum with our current student body, and I believe it's this coming week. We have a forum on May the 24th with the Blind Advisory Committee. We're going to also provide a forum for our Blind Field Services supervisors and counselors, and we're going to provide a forum for our interested individuals and community partners, stakeholders such as CCB, to weigh in on those three questions. We will then distill all of that information captured into a year-by-year plan to move us closer and closer to that vision. So it's a continuous process to make sure that we do two things with OCB: maximize the capacity and maximize the programming to serve the students that come there. Let me speak to the fall resolutions, and then we can maybe open this up for questions if you like, Donna. Last fall, the California Council of the Blind acted on two resolutions and sent them to us. The first resolution was to ensure that materials provided in training or forums, frankly, in all places, were made accessible, which is something that we obviously share a very common goal and interest in. And we have provided a response to the organization on that resolution. A couple of things that we do routinely with the department is, number one is that we have individuals such as Joe Smith, who's sitting out here in the audience, and others from time to time, even myself, where we are testing not only the content but applications to ensure that they are usable and accessible. We provide for alternate formats when people need them, whether it's Braille, tape, although tape recordings are rather outdated these days. We do... Oh, Gene says no. Sorry, Gene.
Now, you can't disrespect our first president here, you know.
Yes,
Gene is
yes,
the second
indeed.
In command, you know. He loves his cassette.
And then in addition to that, we have in an internal, it's called the Rehabilitation Administration Manual, which is DOR's internal policy manual, and we will be putting together a chapter that deals with accessibility, and this, of course, will become one of those main components. I think that all of you will recognize that there's essentially three key components to ensuring accessibility of content. Number one is the hardware, software being used must be working correctly. Number two is that the content that is developed in such a way that the hardware, software can use it. You know, we can talk about Excel, Word, PowerPoints, those kinds of things. And then, of course, number three is that the users have the skills necessary to use both the hardware, software, as well as navigate the content documents themselves. And, of course, we're always open to hearing where we can improve and strengthen that. And we will certainly be looking to the California Council of Blind as well as the Blind Advisory Committee along those lines. The other resolution was on providing... students who go to a four-year, the four-year rate, all 4 years as opposed to just the JC rate for the first 2 years. And so what we are going to do, we have not yet formally responded to that. That is forthcoming. But the direction that we're going to take is to have our advisory bodies weigh in on that and give us some guidance and some direction on that. Of course, we have the Blind Advisory Committee. We have the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Advisory Committee, as well as the State Rehabilitation Council. And to prepare them, to assist them in advising us, we're going to be sharing with them what the impact of that would be, and then having them assist us on where we should take this policy and to address any impacts that it may create as a result of doing that. Let me conclude my remarks here, Donna, if you'd like. And would you like questions and answers now, or do you want us to continue?
You can continue.
3 hours, right?
No.
See, pues. She didn't bring her chunk line in good shape.
I wish, yeah.
Okay. Tony talked about the budget, and he talked about that, you know, we have some $420 million budget. About $55 million of that is... general fund, and the balance of that is either federal fund or third-party funds that in-kind match and dollars that we use. But I'm sure it's no surprise to you guys, if you're anybody's reading the news or the news clips that come on the iPhones these days, you know, the revenue projections are down. I just, at lunch, I went up to check my emails, and there was a blast from the Sacramento Bee where the governor is asking the legislature to man up and do the cuts. That's not good news. But it is the environment that we are working in. And so, you know, we'll continue to do the best that we can. We've been very, very fortunate, as Tony said, with our budget. Do you want to talk about the budget letter, Tony, or?
You did budget letter, but I have comments after that.
Okay, I'll do budget letter. So the governor, there's an executive order that the governor issued a number of months ago, which tasked the Department of Finance to revise the budget process to make it more responsive and to make it, to get it to the point where we were looking truly at performance-based budgeting. And that is a very complicated and long conversation. But one of the things that's already taken place is a budget letter that came out a couple of weeks ago. And what the budget letter essentially is asking the departments to do is to true up the money. And simply put, it's asking us to put the money where we spend it and spend the money where we put it. The state of California has had salary ceilings in place for about 20 years. What this really means is that if we had 1,000 positions, we could not fill 5% of the funds that is required for those 1,000 positions. They had to be vacant at all times to achieve a salary. And essentially, we had less budget for staffing than we actually had positions. So one of the things that this budget letter will do is align the actual number of positions with the number of dollars that are available to spend. And now you might be asking, what does that mean? Well, the short of it is that it means we're going to lose a number of positions that the department has had. Now, the good news is that we're not losing positions that were filled. These are positions that have had to be vacant all these great many years. This also allows us an opportunity to align a number of expenditures that with the budget. For example, our facilities costs. You know, as our facilities costs have crept up, you know, our budget has had to absorb that. Now we get to align the true cost of the facility with the true cost reflected in the budget for that. So this is all something that is being worked on right now. We're working, of course, and a lot of the budget process, unfortunately, is very confidential. So before you ask me how many positions, you know, it's not something that we're at liberty to say. I can tell you that our salary savings in positions was around 120 or so on a year-by-year basis. So we're very hopeful that we will not lose 120 positions. We'll lose somewhere less than that, and how much, we just don't know yet. This is all going through our control agencies, and ultimately will end up in the May revise to the legislature. Let me see if there's any other points here. Tony, you have some comments on this?
Yeah, as Joe said, you know, the truing up of the budget is what's something, it's new for our department. We have been able to, when you have to keep positions vacant, when you have one that stays vacant for a period of time, you'll lose it. So we kind of rotate new people into those positions, and it's a lot of maneuvering, but we've been able to maintain fairly consistent staffing. That will change going forward. We don't anticipate any layoffs, anybody working, but filling behind folks as they retire and move on to other jobs is going to be more difficult. But what I do want to say is, you know, it's a very difficult economy, a very difficult environment we live in. And the governor, I know, and the legislature are pushing for a temporary tax increase in the fall. If that doesn't happen, it's going to get really ugly for us, for all of us, Department of Rehab and all departments and many of you in your personal lives. So there will be a big push, I'm sure, coming through the summer when it gets closer to the election. There's not enough money. The people aren't paying as many taxes. There's not capital gains like we had at one time for a number of reasons. And unless people want to pay for the services that we're used to receiving, including voc rehab, including many of the programs you receive, roads, police, fire, all those things, unless people want to pay for it, they go away. And you can borrow ahead, like we've been doing for a long time, but at some point you have to pay the piper. And that's kind of where we are now. And as we think about where we can cut and where we can keep things going, the issue about paying for four-year universities, well, that's great. We'd love to do that. But at some point, where does that money come from? Does it mean we have to get rid of counseling positions? Does it mean we close offices? Does it mean we stop serving another population? If you don't have any more money coming in, you have to stop the spending somewhere. And those are the difficult decisions that we face, just like you do in your own personal budgets. And that is probably why the governor made that statement today, and I'll look forward to reading it tonight. I may not look forward, is maybe not the right word. But to understand that we have to make those tough decisions. And, it is a difficult time we live in, and we'll get through it. But I hope the general public can see that if you want the great services of the state of California, there's a price to pay, and that is in the way of taxes and assessments and various means that we have to pay for these things, because they don't just come out of the blue. You can't just make them happen. So I'll get off my soapbox, and Joe, you want to say more?
Don, I'll leave it to you to put the hook on the discussion.
Well, my question to you is, and I realize I'm planning on giving 5 or so minutes more because we were behind on your time. So would you like to discuss a little bit more about what's going on or hear from 2 or 3 of our members in the audience? Whatever you wish.
Well, if there's questions, let's give people the opportunity to ask.
Okay. So we will take some questions. Ed's running around with Mike here. Thank you, Ed.
Ed, I want to know where you get purple roller skates with pink polka dots.
And bunny ears. Can you hear me?
No.
Okay, I'm Beryl Brown, Redwood Empire Chapter. I have a question. I was never aware that what kind of a facility you lived in decided whether or not you could have mobility training. We have a member who fractured his hip, is in assisted living, and is going to apparently be staying in that facility and needs to have mobility, and he's been turned down. And I'd like to know why.
And I'm sorry, what was your name?
Beryl Brown.
Beryl?
Redwood Empire.
Well, Beryl, obviously we would need a little more information to be able to really speak to that. It's not something that we're aware of, number one. Number two, whenever somebody is denied services, that always gets our attention. Because, if there's a legitimate reason, that's great. But if there's not, we really want to get with that. I would encourage you, and I'm not sure exactly even what program this might apply to. Do you know? Is it Blind Field Services or older individuals who are blind?
It's an individual who is blind, has been blind, has had training probably a number of years ago, but he's living in a totally different situation.
Yeah.
And he was told that he could not have services because he was in an assisted living facility.
Yeah. What I might ask you to do is, Joe Smith is here, and Joe Smith is our administrator, our former administrator for the Older Individuals Who Are Blind program. It sounds like this might be in that program. Would be to make contact with him and then maybe perhaps provide him with a little bit more detail, and he can work through that issue. You're welcome.
Thank you, Joe. Next question, please. Standing.
This is Jane Cardis, and I graduated from OCB at the end of 1993. And I've become very active and as an advocate in the blind community. But I must say, without the Orientation Center for the Blind, I have no idea where I'd be. I think it is the most fabulous institution, and I'd like you to ask for any of us who had attended OCB there in the audience to perhaps applaud so we'll know how many people are here. That's a lot of folks, and I bet they feel like I do, and I hope we'll see them at the OCB Alumni Luncheon tomorrow.
And Jane, and I would add that when we provide an opportunity to the community to weigh in on the strategic planning, and Donna obviously will receive that invitation, that all of you join. And we're not asking you to travel to Sacramento or any other place, because what we're doing these days is we provide forums that allow you to call in from your home, your cell phone, wherever you may be, and participate in that way. So we... Excellent. And we welcome your input. We welcome any member's input, not just the ones who are former alum or who are alum of OCB, but the community at large that's sitting here. So when that invitation comes, if you're so inclined, join the conversation. Give us your input.
What I would encourage people to do is, if you're on the email lists, you'll see the invitation there. But I would also encourage people to call in to my favorite thing that we have to offer, our service, the California Connection, because I will put it on there as well. And that's for people who use email or call in on the 800 number. So everyone can see that invitation if you either subscribe to the lists or call the connection. Our last question, please, Ed.
Yes, Steve Mendelson, with respect to your new service delivery model, have you had time yet to evaluate whether or not the improvements have been reflected in case outcomes and employment levels and so forth? And do you anticipate those kinds of improvements as one of the major criteria for evaluating the effectiveness of the changes?
So is it Steve? So if I heard this correctly, your question is, will this improve the number of competitive outcomes?
That's right, basically, yes.
Well, you certainly hope so. Not enough blind or visually impaired Californians are going to work. Not enough Californians with disabilities are going to work. And as Tony has said, I've said, you'll hear repeatedly, it's not as if we're going to get more resources these days. So we've got to get a lot more efficient and a lot more effective with the resources we have. And I think this is one way that we can do that. And we've got to find, I'm going to go back to the three questions about strategic planning. Key to me in those three questions is, number one, what is it that we're not doing that we need to start doing? We had this discussion with the Blind Advisory Committee a couple of weeks ago. There was a lot of very good discussion that came out of that, but it's not as easy as the question as it seems. And Donna, I think you just said correct. It's not as easy. And I'll tell you, if you think that question is tough, you should have heard the discussion around the question, what are we going to stop doing? Okay? Because everybody's always willing to say, start something new, but don't quit anything. Well, here's the story. If you're already overloaded and you're going to do more things, you're not going to give up anything. Remember my famous quote about change? But yeah, the short answer is absolutely. We look forward to improving our effectiveness, our efficiency, and getting more people to work. Yeah, Tony reminded me of this when he and I started working periodically. He'll tell me this on occasion. Employment and independence are the opposite side of the same coin. So let's get people employed. Let's get them independent. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. Okay, the next item on our agenda. Oh, do I listen to the masses? I don't know.
Election year, remember that.
I guess I'll listen to the masses. We are a grassroots organization after all, and the membership is the supreme authority at convention. Let us have one door prize. And, oh, this one's for me. It's a bag of fudge, and Ed is going to draw my name. And the winner is Mike Keithley. Yay.
Okay.
All right. Now, all of a sudden, Mike has many, many, many more friends. And for those who want a description, Mike is sitting right up in the front row in one of the center aisles. So I can help you find him. Okay. The next item on our agenda is the in-home supportive service program. That is definitely a hot topic. Where have we come and where are we heading? Our moderator is someone that I think we all know, Mr. Jeff Tom, who is chair of our Governmental Affairs Committee. And, of course, he resides in Sacramento, California. Our panelists are Hafida Hebek, and she is the branch chief of policy and litigation. She's working as chief of that branch. Within the Adult Program Division, California Department of Social Services in Sacramento, we also have Dan Bravik, Associate Managing Attorney, Disability Rights California in Oakland, California. And with that, I will welcome all of you and hand it over to Jeff Tom. Jeff?
Okay. Thank you, Donna. In the late 1990s, the United States Supreme Court in the Olmstead decision interpreted the ADA as giving the right to a person with a disability to live in the least restrictive environment. But California, as the innovators that we usually are, at least more often than not, seem to be, had our in-home supportive services program in 1970, whose goal was basically the same as that of the Olmstead decision. However, nothing is forever, and things are always changing in this world. That's the one constant we know about. And today we want to explore what is new in that program. We want to do so from the perspective of the State Department of Social Services, which has primary oversight over the program, and from Disability Rights California, an agency concerned with protecting the rights of consumers. You have the introduction, the bios of my two panelists in the program, and Donna has introduced them. And rather than me giving you that information, I'd rather give my panelists the time to talk and hear them. So first, I want to turn it over to Hafida Hebek.
Hello. Hello. Hello? I have to eat it. Look it this way, it's better. Hello? Okay. So thank you for inviting me here today. I am pleased to be part of this convention. And as Jeff was stating, and it's included in the program, I will be talking about the current changes in the program, and also as I was saying, I will be talking about the current changes in the in-home supportive services program, and also I will address the department's efforts in resolving some of the challenges that are facing the blind and visually impaired IHSS recipients. And lastly, as Jeff stated, I will provide you with an overview of the governor's proposed changes as it relates to the IHSS program. So starting with the recent changes in the IHSS program, the Senate Bill 72 established a requirement for the healthcare certification as a condition of eligibility to receive in-home supportive services. The healthcare certification requirements became effective last August, and counties are currently using the form for both applicants and recipients. And also the fiscal year 11-12 budget package included mandates that in the event that the state budget revenue forecast falls short of the $87 billion, a 20% across the border reduction in IHSS service hours will be implemented starting January 1st, 2012. So as such, the Department of Social Services issued on November 29th an all-county letter providing the counties with instructions for implementing the reduction. However, on December 1st, 2011, the court granted a temporary restraining order against the department, prohibiting the Department of Social Services from implementing this reduction or taking any actions. As a result, the department issued a subsequent ACL, an all-county letter, rescinding the prior ACL that was that implemented the program. Counties were instructed immediately halt the implementation of the reduction. And on February, March 2012, the Federal District Court, Judge Claudia Wolken, released her order and ruled in favor of the plaintiffs, supporting the original preliminary injunction to stop the 20% IHSS reduction in service hours. CDSS has complied with the court order. Now, more positive aspects of the current budget. The budget did include proposals that will provide savings without reducing benefits. One of these proposals is the community first choice option known as the 1915K state plan. Upon the approval of the state's plan amendment that the Department of Social Services, in collaboration with the Department of Healthcare Services, submitted it last December to the CMS, this option will allow California to receive 6% of additional federal monies while providing California the opportunity to enhance and expand the services to IHSS recipients. Example of such services include expanding the backup plan and risk assessment to all community first choice option recipients, which now represent around 98% of our current IHSS recipients, and allow recipients to receive voluntary training to help them with selecting, managing, and dismissing their providers. On February 29, 2012, we received a firmer request for additional information from CMS, which stopped the 90-day clock for the approval of our state plan amendment. We are working closely with Department of Healthcare Services to answer CMS questions and provide them with the revised and final, hopefully, state plan amendment by the end of the next week so we can claim the additional 6%, which is over $200 million of additional money that can come to California retroactive to December 1st, 2011. As of the changes we have made to address some of the challenges facing the blind and visually impaired IHSS recipients, one of the largest projects completed by the Adult Programs Division last year within the Department of California Social Services was converting all of our online documents to be reader accessible. This project included program forms, all our county letters, program information, and program data. We converted scanned documents going back to early 90s in order to make them accessible. This version can now be accessed by a blind or visually impaired person, provided that they have a computer and they have a software within their computer so they can the information can be read to them. And another project we just started 2 months ago, we're hoping to create an accessible IHSS provider timesheet for the blind and visually impaired recipients to be able to complete so they can validate their IHSS provider's hours. We are welcoming any information or any help you could suggest to us. And Donna, please, if anybody has any suggestion, you could send it to Donna and she can send it to me, because we are working on this project, and I think it will be especially coming into the managed care in the future. This is something that could really help our 20,000 or so recipients benefit from this feature. regarding the governor's proposed changes and given the difficult fiscal situation California is facing, the administration proposes to restrict the IHSS hours for domestic-related services to recipients residing in a shared living arrangement starting July 1st, 2012. This restriction is solely for services that are currently met in common with members of the household. However, there are two exemptions to these restrictions. The first restriction, if the housemaid can substantiate a physical or a mental impairment that will prevent him or her from providing the services. The second exemption is if the household is made up for all IHSS recipients. And again, domestic-related services include housework, meal preparation, cleanup, laundry, shopping for food, and household errands. The proposal does not affect any IHSS authorized hours for personal care services. The second proposal included in the governor's budget is the Coordinated Care Initiative. As it relates to the IHSS integration into managed care, the Coordinated Care Initiative proposed trial bill language that you all know was released on March 23rd by Department of Healthcare Services is designed in a way that preserves the current IHSS program's core principles, protections, and services that the program has been known for over 30 years. And just to name few of these protections and services, the integration of IHSS into managed care will not affect the current services. The entire array of IHSS services will remain available. IHSS recipients will continue to be the employer with the ability to hire, fire, and direct their providers. Recipients will continue to be able to request an IHSS needs assessment anytime they have a change in condition or living arrangements. Recipients will continue to be able to appeal any decisions. Counties will continue their traditional role in the IHSS program, meaning that the IHSS social workers will perform all assessments, make the final determination of recipients' authorized hours. County social workers will work with managed care and participate on a care coordination team as needed for complex care cases. IHSS providers will continue to be paid by Department of Social Services through the case management information and payrolling system. And all other functions will continue, such as direct deposit. Public authority will continue to administer the health benefit for IHSS providers, maintain a provider registry, train providers, and engage in collective bargaining for the purposes of wages, hours, and other terms and conditions of the employment. And Department of Social Services and Department of Healthcare Services will continue their roles of providing quality assurance and program oversight. Also, the proposed policy will gradually transition IHSS into managed care. In 2013, the integration would be in the counties participating in the demonstration project. As you all know, on April 4th, Department of Healthcare Services with our department, Department of Aging, announced that Los Angeles, Orange, San Diego, and San Mateo counties will be the initial participants in the demonstration project. And they are exploring additional six counties. But for these four counties, IHSS, starting January 1st, 2013, will be part of the benefits package under managed care. In 2014, the integration of IHSS will expand to the remaining managed care counties. And in 2015, the integration will include the remaining fee-for-service counties. Okay. Just real quick, I just want to mention that last Friday, Healthcare Department of Healthcare Services released the schedule for the 7 stakeholder work groups. One of the work groups that was held yesterday is beneficiary notifications, appeals, and protections. And some of the ones that you may want to keep track of is the IHSS coordination and integrations. It will start May 11, and I will encourage you to be part of that. And before I close, I just want to echo my director and my deputy director's commitment in ensuring that the transition of IHSS into managed care is done correctly, safely, respectfully, and with a focus on improving outcomes for our IHSS recipients. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. We'll turn it over to Dan. Dan Bravick.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me to the convention. I'm glad to be here. I'm Dan Berzovich. I'm an attorney with Disability Rights California. I work out of the Oakland office. As you probably know, we're a statewide organization, and we advocate for the rights of people with disabilities. And we've represented people in various lawsuits regarding IHSS that so far have stopped some of the cuts. What I'd like to do, I don't want to duplicate what was said so far, so I'm going to highlight a couple of points. First, I want to talk about the anti-fraud and provider qualification initiatives. Then I want to talk a little bit about the IHSS lawsuits and where we are with that. And then I want to address certain issues with integration of IHSS into Medi-Cal managed care. That's something which is coming, and we have to make sure that the right to continue to receive IHSS services is protected. First of all, with the provider qualifications, as you probably know, a few years ago, the legislature decided that providers had to undergo some preliminary training, and also providers convicted of certain crimes such as child abuse or elder and dependent adult abuse are not qualified to be providers would have to be fingerprinted so that there could be a background check and so forth. Some of those provider qualification requirements are required by federal law for all providers under the Medi-Cal or federal Medicaid programs. Some of those requirements can't be waived. Some of those requirements can be waived, though, if the IHSS recipient knows about the criminal convictions and is willing to have the provider as their provider anyway. we can provide information on the conditions for those sorts of waivers. Fingerprinting requirements have been something of a hardship because there's a charge for fingerprinting. Sometimes that can be waived. We can help with issues around waiver of fingerprinting requirements. Finally, as far as training of providers, originally there was a video that was being used that was developed by one of the counties, and it was a rather negative video. It warned about fraud and had a video clip of the jail door clanking shut and the bars of the jail, things like that. The department has now developed a more professional provider training video, and we think that it's much more positive, and we're happy that the department has done that. What we would like to see the legislature do, though, is pay providers to go to that training because it's really a hardship for people to have to go to that training without compensation. So that's one of the things we're working on. One of the things that we're happy to say is that the legislature has repealed the requirement that IHSS recipients place their fingerprint on the provider timesheets. That was enacted into law a few years ago, but law enforcement acknowledged that that kind of a fingerprint is really not useful in identifying people. So that requirement has now been repealed. There's not going to be a requirement for fingerprints on timesheets. I want to mention briefly about the anti-fraud efforts. One of the things that the department initiated was an unannounced home visit program. Any IHSS recipient can be subjected to that. And the purpose was not necessarily, at least the stated purpose, was not necessarily to identify fraud, but to make sure that services were being provided properly. In other words, to make sure that that enough hours were being provided and that the provider was actually providing the hours that that were authorized. There have been some county excesses around home visits, but there are specific standards that the counties have to follow, and we have information on our website on what to do if you're subjected to an unannounced home visit and how to handle it. You do have an obligation to cooperate, of course, but at the same time, there are limits on what the investigator, what the social worker can look for and what they can do. As far as the litigation goes, as you might remember, a few years ago, the legislature passed a budget cut that would have taken IHSS away from certain people who can't perform services, certain services themselves, but who nevertheless did not have the functional limitations that the legislature thought were important, most important. So people who couldn't perform services without some assistance, such as queuing or reminding, would lose those services, even though without those services they couldn't perform the task themselves. Also, people who needed minimal assistance to provide the services. In other words, they could do part of the services themselves but couldn't do the service at all unless they had assistance. Those people were going to lose those particular services. The court several years ago issued an injunction against those cutbacks, and that injunction is still in effect. That's on appeal in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and we'll see what happens with that. Also, several years ago, there was a 3.6% across-the-board reduction in IHSS services. No lawsuit was filed against that, and that reduction went into effect. That reduction is scheduled to sunset on June 30th of this year, but there are proposals in the legislature to continue it. That would be in addition to the 20% across-the-board reduction. So what we're talking about is a proposal for a 23.6% reduction overall, almost a quarter of the IHSS payments to most people. As mentioned, those 20% cuts have been stopped from going into effect because there's a district court injunction. The department hasn't appealed yet, but they may do that any time now. We don't know what they'll do. We expect that they will appeal. there are exceptions to the 20% cutback, not to the 3.6% cutback, but to the 20% cutback. And we have materials on our website about how to qualify for exceptions. One of the changes that the department is going to have to make is rather than requiring people to apply for the exception, the department is going to have to determine whether people are entitled to that exception in the first instance. Okay, finally, what I want to do is briefly mention about managed care, and you'll hear more about that this afternoon. But what the Department of Healthcare Services is talking about when they want to integrate in-home supportive services into Medi-Cal managed care is that the managed care organizations would be responsible for payment in some respect for both IHSS and for nursing home care. And there would be some sort of an upfront payment that's not a fee-for-service payment, but what's called a capitation payment. In other words, a flat rate that would cover both IHSS and long-term care. This hopefully will be an incentive for managed care organizations to see to it that people move from nursing homes to the community, because the nursing home care is more expensive than IHSS. And that's the hope. But what we have to do is make sure that we're careful to build in protections for beneficiaries so that people won't lose the community-based services that they have as a result of the managed care organization's incentive to save money by denying services. So those are some of the things we're working on, and you'll be hearing more about those as time goes on. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Donna, are we out of time, or what's our status here?
I'm sorry, Jeff. I was apologizing for mispronouncing names.
Yes, well, I was going to apologize as well. Are we out of time, or are there time for a question or two?
We have time for two questions.
Okay. Any questions from either of our panelists? Oh, Dan, could you, while they're getting the question here, could you give, and maybe both of you for that matter, give your websites?
Sure. Our website is disabilityrightsca, as in California, .org. So one word, disabilityrightsca.org.
And Department of Social Services website is cdss.ca.gov/aged-blind-disabled. With no space.
Okay. Question. My name is Teddy Joy Rimhild, and I serve on the both on the Olmsted Advisory Committee and the IHSS Coalition Advisory Group. And I want to say, first of all, that we owe so much to the efforts of Disability Rights California to help maintaining this program in California.
Thank you very much.
My colleague on the Olmsted Advisory is Deborah Doctor from the Sacramento Office of Disability Rights California. But my question is this. Once that this IHSS program is fully integrated into managed care by the end of 2015, what recourse will a consumer have to appeal refusal of service or inadequacy of service? Where will they go to appeal the program needs, their program needs, after it's fully integrated into IHSS? Thank you.
Okay, I can answer that. First of all, the state fair hearing system is going to remain in place, so people will still have a right to state fair hearings. There are some things that haven't been decided yet. For example, if IHSS goes into managed care, are people going to have to exhaust an internal managed care grievance process before they can go to fair hearing? We don't know the answer to that yet. We hope that people won't, and that the fair hearing process won't be changed at all. But anyway, that's one possibility. The other wrinkle in all of this is that people who have both Medicare and Medi-Cal will be in Medi-Cal managed care. That's the state's proposal. They're starting off doing that on a pilot basis in four counties. San Mateo is one county. Orange is another county. Los Angeles County is a third county. So you wonder if Los Angeles is included, how much of a pilot is it? But anyway, what is going to happen is that Medicare and Medi-Cal payments are going to have to be coordinated or blended somehow. And the separate appeals procedures for Medicare and Medi-Cal are also going to have to be coordinated. One proposal is to use the Medicare appeals procedure for both Medicare and Medi-Cal. We think that's a very bad idea because the Medi-Cal appeals procedure is so much better and is operated at the state level rather than the federal level. But anyway, that's one proposal. So our proposal will be that people can use whichever appeal procedure they want, either the Medicare appeal procedure or the Medi-Cal procedure. But in any event, there will still be an appeals process. We just have to advocate for, all of us have to advocate for the best appeals process possible.
And just to add to the answer, as I was stated in my presentation, that there is a beneficiary notification appeals and protection work group that started yesterday, and there are another five meetings that there'll be healthcare services and all the participants, and it's open to everybody to be part of that conversation to iron out what kind of processes to answer the question, the very question you're asking. So I will urge you to participate in this work group.
Hello, I'm Sally McGuire.
Okay. You'll need to speak closer into the mic.
Hello, I am Sally McGuire. And I wondered if IHSS goes under managed care, will the recipient of services have any choice in who their provider, who their worker is, or will that be provided through the managed care?
The trailable language that was released back on March 23rd, Section 3, Article 4.6, which speaks to the IHSS program, is very clear about the core principles of IHSS are maintained, meaning the IHSS recipient still has the ability to hire, fire, and direct their provider.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm sorry, I realize we have some more questions, but we need to move on to our next presentation. I'll give it back over to Jeff for any final.
Okay, I want to thank my panelists, and I want to also just mention that I am one of the many members of that beneficiary notifications work group. So if any of you, and which I was going to tell you tonight, but I'll tell you now, and so if any of you have information that you want me to convey, please get in touch with me over the next few weeks so that I can take your opinions as part of the input that this organization has in that process. So I want to thank again our panelists for a very enlightening discussion. Thank you to both Hafida and Dan.
Thank you very much.
Yes, you too.
We also ended up getting a question from one of our listeners who are listening on ACB Radio, so we had several questions. The next item on our agenda is managed healthcare. It's promises, and pitfalls. This panel is moderated by Jeff Tom, Chair, Governmental Affairs Committee. And the panelists are Laurel Mildred, MSW, Mildred Consulting and Advocacy in Sacramento, California, and Maya Altman, CEO, Health Plan of San Mateo, San Mateo, California. Please give them a nice, great big hand.
Okay, I'm going to, again, truncate my, since we use truncated domes in this organization, I'm going to truncate my introductions. But I am going to say I'm very pleased to have both these panelists. I've come to know Laurel Mildred of Mildred Consulting over the past number of months, and she is really one of the deep thinkers in the managed care field, and I think that you're going to be very interested in some of what she has to say. Having done a lot of work in this area. And then we are extremely pleased to have, well, let me just put it this way. We're here in San Mateo County, and there is one thing, there's hardly anything in this state that people seem to agree on in the managed care field, I've come to realize. But the one thing that just about, well, it's perhaps everybody agrees upon, is the Cadillac of managed care plans is healthcare of San Mateo County. So we are pleased to have Maya Altman, the CEO of that plan, and Laurel Mildred. And without further introduction, I'm going to turn it over to Laurel first.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jeff. I'm really honored and pleased to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me. And I appreciate having had the opportunity to work with Jeff as well. He's such a valued asset to all of the processes that we're working in. I have a little bit more speech than I have time, so I'm going to move a little bit quickly through a few topics. I wanted to just say that I've worked in politics in Sacramento for about 25 years, and but about 12 years ago, I had personal experiences with mental health issues, and so at that time, I became really interested in disability policy, first in mental health policy, and then in other disability policy, and so my work really has been a lot with nonprofit organizations or those of us who have personal experience and how to bring it into the policy context, so that's sort of the background of my work. I'm going to try and do three things quickly. Jeff kind of asked me to describe the landscape or the context for this change. I think all of us, this is happening so quickly, we're trying to evaluate where the right pressure points are, where the right places to have advocacy. And I'm going to offer you my perspective that some of those conversations are starting at the wrong place. And I'm going to try and explain why. But, you know, the conversation of should we have managed care in California is going to be a... Perhaps I'm going to suggest the wrong place to start the conversation. I'm going to suggest some more effective places to dive in. I'm going to touch on some of the specific proposals, sort of high level. A few people have gone over some of them. And then most importantly, and why I'm going to rush through the first part, the third thing I'd like to get to is most important, is to suggest some key ideas of the social model and the disability rights agenda that all of us can bring into the conversation in all of the different processes that we have an opportunity to participate in. So the first thing I wanted to talk about are the drivers of systems change and why we are here at this place. And I think we're all very aware of the economic recession, that it began in December of 2007. Tony Sauer covered this. It officially ended 18 months later, but you know it's difficult if you look at state budgets to know that because the recovery has been so slow for states. The other major driver is healthcare reform, and we kind of know that, but I'm going to bring out some of the specifics as to the way that that's driving the changes. And of course, the Affordable Care Act passed on March 23rd of 2010. The recession is so real for all of us, it's very hard to hear that it's over because we're still experiencing cuts. And we're not the only ones. 28 states project that this year, 2012, tax revenues will come in below pre-recession levels. So we've had all of these cuts,
and we still are experiencing cuts, and that's one of the reasons we're here. Since 2008-09, California has cut $15 billion for just from Health and Human Services programs, and consequently has lost another $15 billion in matching federal funds. So the California Budget Project said that for fiscal year 2010-11, general fund spending in California was lower as a share of the state's economy than in 33 of the past 40 years. So that's longer than my career. So I guess I would just say that our pain is very real. and the steps that we're having to take to deal with that are pretty dramatic. I think people are very aware, so I'll just mention a couple of the things about the healthcare reform. We know that it reformed the public and private health insurance systems. It increased coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. I'm one of those people. It's hard for me to get health insurance if I'm not attached to an employer who provides it. State health insurance exchanges were created. And really importantly, an expansion of health coverage to over 30 million Americans. This includes an expansion of Medicaid eligibility to 138% of federal poverty level, so people can have just a tiny bit more money and still qualify. Kaiser estimates in California that's going to cover 1.4 million people by 2016, and a fifth of them, for various reasons of the rules, are expected to have mental health and substance use disorders, and I'm going to suggest that California is really unprepared to deal with that challenge. The other thing about the Affordable Care Act is sort of for the first time it moved into long-term services and supports. And that's why we're seeing the conversation about IHSS, waivers, other home and community-based services. And this is something that in the advocacy community we've said for a long time, we want the whole person, right? We don't want it to just be medical model, and we want social supports to be part of it. I would just note that sometimes it's uncomfortable to get what you wish for, because suddenly feels out of control. It made me laugh when Jeff said I was a deep thinker about managed care, because all I know about managed care 6 months ago was I had a Kaiser card, and that was the extent of it. But we're all having to catch up very quickly. I want to just give the state a bit of credit for a minute, because states are taking some risks, and California is out there in implementing the Affordable Care Act so that it can benefit its citizens, coping with difficult situations. But the weak economy continues to drive Medicaid enrollment up, so states' costs are going up. Medicaid expansion is going to cost states over time. That federal coverage is going to go down a little bit, and states will have to pay more. The RF stimulus funding ended in 2009. The per capita health care costs are increasing faster than the economy. Who knows what congressional budget actions will be? There's a lack of final regulations to guide implementation, so the states could roll some of these programs out and then have to redo them. And finally, we all know about the pending litigation in the U.S. Supreme Court. So I just say, having worked with policymakers for a long time, I think that there's been some courage involved in trying to move down this road. When I feel discomforted by the amount of change, I do try to understand that we're all together in a process of change and trying to come up with the best result that we can. So despite those risks, the incentives of the Affordable Care Act towards integration, better utilization of services, whole person solutions, and the recession are driving these rapid system changes. There's an AARP report called On the Verge that just says many states are undergoing or about to undergo a dizzying array of transformations in their LTSS, long-term services and support systems, and California is one of them. One of the key solutions here, and we're talking about different things, and you may be very tuned into the dual-eligible project or the integration of IHSS and other home and community-based services, but what we're really talking about here is various aspects of managed long-term services and supports. That's a plan in which a contractor, a managed care organization, is responsible for providing beneficiaries with a defined set of services in exchange for a prepaid capitation payment.
And as Dan mentioned, it includes both skilled nursing and home and community-based services. And I am really pleased to be here with Maya, who is such expertise and a fine organization. And I was in a meeting with her, as I recall her saying, we want to be at risk for skilled nursing facility services. We want to do the job that needs to be done in terms of managing those services effectively. And that is, I've worked a lot on Olmsted, that is one of the promises of what's occurring here, is better utilization, less utilization of institutional services, and more utilization and investment in home and community-based services. There will probably, likely be people who get more home and community-based services after this change, because there will be less utilization of skilled nursing facilities and other institutions. 12 states have already have managed long-term services and supports. 11 more states are implementing them in 2012-13. And in addition to that, 28 states are undertaking dual-eligible integration projects. It's breathtaking. It's sweeping across this country as fast as you can imagine. People like me are running around trying to understand the best practices from the states that have done it so that we're making good public policy. Mistakes are being made and will be made. But I just want, I want all of us to be relevant, effective, and powerful in our advocacy. So you can see that over half the states in the nation are already there or are getting there fast. So trying to stop the train, it means we're going to get run over. One of the things that happened is that California's Bridge to Reform started in 2010 with a bill by Senator Steinberg. It authorized a five-year 1115 waiver. So we know that that put people, seniors and people with disabilities into managed health care, and we're familiar with that at this point. It also made $8 billion of new Medicaid funding available in California for uninsured adults and for improvements. So each of these things has sort of a bitter pill and an advantage. It also provided authority for the dual demonstration projects that have been mentioned in up to four counties. And the federal government, CMS, gave California $1 million to plan for this. Okay, so when the federal government gives you $1 million to do something, they expect you to do it. And so, you know, it's a good thing to understand that that has already occurred. Just a couple things about people who are dual eligible. We're talking, as Dan said, about low-income individuals who qualify for both Medicare and Medi-Cal. It's important to understand that for this population, 7% of Medi-Cal beneficiaries are accounting for 75% of the program costs, and most of that is for institutional care. Now, that's a really staggering statistic, and it is an opportunity for better utilization of public resources, which we have advocated for a long time. There are several different proposals, as people have said. I sort of put them into three buckets. There's the dual eligible integration, and that's important because it's the gold standard model that will likely be the model of care in California all over the state very soon for everything. Outside of that, the governor's coordinated care initiative requires phased-in mandatory enrollment of all Medi-Cal beneficiaries into managed care for the full continuum of services, including long-term services and support. So that's what you were hearing about IHSS, except I would point out that it's not just IHSS. It's all of the home and community-based waivers, adult day health care, MSSP, it's all of them. And then finally, rural counties don't have managed care, and so that will be the third piece. The third bucket is expanding managed care to rural counties. That's going to be quite a challenge. So moving into the, I'm not sure how I'm doing on time here, into strategies. One of the strategies I want to be sure and suggest to people are to start to begin planning to do business with managed care plans, to develop business models for the aging and the disability network, to create contracting relationships with plans. That's absolutely essential for our communities. I wanted to just note some of the things about moving into understanding managed care. I work with California Foundation for Independent Living Centers. We've sort of
had this struggle. We fought against the 1115 waiver to put people with seniors and people with disabilities into managed health care, and we lost. We didn't know the plans. They didn't know us. There's a steep learning curve on the technical side, all of these acronyms. And most of all, we're worried about how to preserve, protect, and advance the social model. So my final comments just go to that point. We developed three areas that are critical that we were trying to bring into all advocacy, and I have been operating from that. Consumer direction and protection, preserving and strengthening the nonprofit system of community-based safety net providers, including independent living centers, and setting the right fiscal incentives. Dan talked about that, and we think that that is at the center of everything. We also want to talk to the plans. I had an opportunity to present for them in Southern California recently and talk about the things we value about our lives and the social model. And one of them is that the theories that provide a framework for the social model are different than the medical model, and we understand this very well. It's very good to articulate it. Some people know this. Some people, organizations are very, have experience in this, and some do not. So we want to talk about the whole person theory, the ecological systems model. I want to talk about the strengths perspective and the wellness perspective. You can have a disability and thrive. We want to talk about family theory and culture theory, the recovery model for mental health, the resilience model, which speaks to children and their ability to thrive despite mental health challenges, and most of all, the empowerment theory, where we are in charge of our own lives and making our own decisions. We want to explain that the person cannot be understood separately from their environment, and that social justice is deeply embedded in social model theories. I took the opportunity when I spoke to the plans to mention some of our context, which includes the historical treatment of people with disabilities, unsightly beggar ordinances that barred people with disabilities from appearing in public, forced commitment to institutions, relegation to segregated education in order to avoid hindering the education of non-disabled children, subject to job discrimination, focus of euthanasia policies advocated by leading social advocates of the 1930s, forced sterilization, particularly those with developmental disabilities, up until the 1960s. That's recent history. And policies that exist to this day, Tony was talking about this earlier, that keep millions of working-age adults out of the job market by means of social welfare policies that provide health insurance, personal assistance services, and payment for assistive devices only as long as they stay unemployed and impoverished. So that's our context, and we want to bring that into these programs so that that becomes part of the conversation and how services are delivered. In terms of institutionalization, you know, the power of spending money for institutions is on our side in this conversation because people are talking about better utilization. But we want to remind people that the words of the Olmsted decision, that unnecessary institutionalization perpetuates unwarranted assumptions that people with disabilities are incapable or unworthy of participating in community life. This is not just about money, that this is about people's lives and their dignity. I want to talk about stigma, attitudes and beliefs that motivate people to fear, reject, and avoid those who are seen as different. And we want to talk about discrimination, which occurs when individuals and societies act on those feelings of stigma and discomfort by depriving people of their rights. I want to outline the key elements of the disability rights agenda and make sure that it's part of the conversation. Some of those things include legal protection from discrimination, the right to receive quality treatment of services, the right to refuse treatment or services, due process in all professional or governmental decision-making that affects us, equal access to public transportation and accommodations, and most fundamental, opposition to forced institutionalization. And correspondingly, I think this is something that gets lost as we talk about utilization and fiscal reimbursement. In order to live outside of communities, we need the right to services in the community. I mean, in order to live outside of institutions, you can't just isolate people without the right services that they need to live.
Okay, thank you very much for that. And yes, and now we're going to turn it over to Maya Altman.
Good job. Good afternoon. My name is Maya Altman, and I'm the CEO of the Health Plan of San Mateo here in San Mateo County. So first of all, I want to welcome you to San Mateo County. Thank you for being here, and thank you for inviting me. I feel I'm very honored to come speak to your group. So I wanted to step back a little bit, and I don't know how much people here know about managed care. And it's a little daunting to represent managed care because I don't want to represent managed care. I could just represent my own plan and what we've done and what we're thinking about. But I do want to talk about the managed care, Medi-Cal managed care landscape here in California because it's very different than the rest of the country. So, you know, my background, I did not grow up wanting to be a managed care executive. I actually worked for the county health department for about 11 years here in San Mateo County. And I came, I did not have a managed care background, but I came to the health plan of San Mateo because I saw a lot of opportunities for improving health care in this community. Using the local public managed care plan as a vehicle for community problem solving. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about what that means. So we're we're called a county organized health system, which is one kind of managed care plan here in California. We've been around for 25 years. We have always had seniors and people with disabilities enrolled in our plan. This is true for all the county organized health systems. We have always had dual eligible members enrolled in our plan, at least on the Medicaid side, on the Medi-Cal side. We are part of a larger public, we call ourselves public plans. In other counties, the so-called two-plan counties, it's more of a competitive situation. So, for example, in our county, everybody's on Medi-Cal is enrolled in our plan. In Alameda County, for example, there are two plans. There's the Alameda Alliance for Health, which is a public plan created by the local board of supervisors. And then there's a commercial plan, in Alameda's case, Blue Cross. But the public plans all share some certain qualities. They are, as I said, they are public governmental entities. They are their members are appointed by the local board of supervisors. Their meetings are subject to the Brown Act, which means they are all open. Their finances are completely transparent and public. Their decision-making process should be public. If they're not, you know, the community needs to, somebody needs legal aid or needs to get involved or make sure that they are. Thing about public plans is they really only exist in California. And even in the counties where there are two plans, as I said, you know, a public plan and a private plan, 75% of the Medi-Cal beneficiaries across the state have chosen the public plan. So they have totally squashed the commercial plans in terms of competition. And so people are voting with their feet. They have a choice of plans, and they're choosing the public plans. And Laurel mentioned about how these changes are sweeping across the country. In a lot of other states, the states are just saying, you know, okay, whatever plan wants to bid, you know, Aetna, United Health, all these huge commercial plans, Anthem, are coming in and bidding on the business. And I think that's a bad thing. And I think we have a great opportunity here in California because we have these local community-based public plans that are accountable to their communities. And the kind of advocacy, and I think Laurel's suggestions were great. You can get involved with the plan in your community and talk to them, and you can make a difference. Because I know that people, I've seen people come to our public meetings and influence the our boards about what they decide. We have a whole, you know, system of consumer advisory committees, physician advisory committees. And so, for example, when California cut some of the Medi-Cal optional benefits a few years ago, like dental, like podiatry, like vision, we were able to make some decisions locally to restore some of those things. We weren't able to do anything about dental. That's not covered in our plan. But we did restore some of those other benefits. And the consumers that advise us, you know, we all work together to figure out, okay, what can we afford to do and what can we... I've got 5 minutes. So that's my speech about managed care. I think, that, as I said, there's tremendous potential. I think what... the reason we've been working on what we call long-term care integration, we've been working on it for 20 years in this county because we see the potential. we spend we're responsible for nursing home care right now. We spend $150,000 a year for somebody to live in a nursing home. That's a lot of money. Somebody mentioned assisted living centers. We cannot pay for somebody to receive services in assisted living, even though it's a much less costly and many people would prefer to live in assisted living as opposed to a nursing home. But right now we're restricted from doing that. Under this program, we're going to have the flexibility to use our dollars wisely to make sure that people can live in the least restrictive setting of their choice. I think we focus a lot on preventative care. We are measured in terms of how well we provide preventative care as well as how well we provide chronic disease care. There are evaluations of managed care plans called HEDIS, and you should look at how the plans in your area do. And that's something to focus on. If a plan consistently does poorly, it's like, well, why? Are you not making the necessary investments to provide quality? I think we are philosophically, we are completely in line with the social model and preserving the principles of the social model, particularly in IHSS. And we are trying to figure out how that's going to work, how to integrate those services, preserve and look at the whole person, but preserve the best parts of the social model. A lot of what we do is provide coordination of care, again, for people who really need it. I mean, a lot of people, particularly people on the IHSS program, are doing just fine. They're independent. They need certain supports, and they want to be left alone. I've been to a lot of stakeholder meetings. I've certainly heard that message. But there are people who aren't doing so well. There are people that are in an acute crisis. There are people who have chronic conditions that aren't being taken care of. So we want to make sure we really target our services and our help for those people. And I think we will, in the end, our goal is to increase home community-based services because we think that is the best way to keep people out of hospitals and to keep people out of nursing homes. So my suggestion to you, I think Laurel's strategies were great. I think you have to be really engaged at the local level with the health plan. You have to fight to make sure they're providing high quality, and you have to be informed about your rights. I think the debate around the consumer protections is extremely important, and we have a lot of protections in our plan for folks, but we want to make sure that those protections are preserved and even extended as this integration moves forward. So I'll stop there. Hope I didn't rush through too quickly. I'm interested in any questions people may have.
I think we're out of time, but I just want to say that I think, as you can see, and I almost hate to use this example being the Titanic anniversary, but we've barely touched the tip of the iceberg on this subject, because it is just there's just so much to it. And I really want to thank our outstanding panelists for just giving us so much to think about. Thank you very much, both of you. Thank you, and I'll turn it back over to Donna.
Thank you very much. These are definitely topics that a lot of us have interest in, for good reason. So, the next item on our agenda is guide dog mobility training for clients with multiple disabilities at Guide Dogs for the Blind. And we have Mark Gillard, who is a field manager with Guide Dogs for the Blind in San Rafael, California. I'll give it over to you.
Thank you very much. Well, good afternoon, everybody, and thank you very much for the invitation to present to you today. I see a number of familiar faces in the audience. I'd like to say hello to some GDB alumni and their dogs. And once again, it's a real pleasure to be here. In regarding the topic, servicing clients with multiple disabilities with guide dogs at Guide Dogs for the Blind, I'd like to preface my presentation by saying that every person, client, student, graduate, applicant, whatever name you want to give an individual, has their own unique individual characteristics, strengths, and challenges which they bring to the learning or training process. At Guide Dogs for the Blind, we have always trained people with disabilities in addition to blindness or visual impairment. However, what I'd like to talk about today is we have moved in the direction of offering more individualized programs and instruction which better suit people with additional disabilities or challenges in addition to blindness. So in 2009, we had a very detailed internal continuous quality improvement process go on at Guide Dogs for the Blind. And what happened following that was that we introduced a trial program which resulted in significant changes to guide dog client residential training programs, also known as classes for those people not familiar with the guide dog vernacular. And this has occurred at both of our two campuses. We have a campus here in San Rafael, California, which I'm sure the CCB membership are familiar with, but also we have a campus just outside Portland, Oregon. Yeah, some Oregon graduates. The boring campus, that's the one. Boring Oregon. Of most relevance to the topic today, servicing people with multiple disabilities, were the changes to class length and a key reduction in the ratio of instructor to student during training. These are the changes in particular which have been found to provide very positive impacts in terms of better servicing students with multiple disabilities, and I should also mention health challenges. By way of explanation, and I'm sure there's some of you in the room that can relate to this, the traditional GDB training model, as is the case or was the case in many of the American and global guide dog organisations, was a four-week class training model, 28 days. For first-time students, and this had a ratio of four students to one instructor. This has been replaced now by either a three-week class with three students to one instructor or a two-week class with two students per instructor. And both class types are now available to first-time students. And this is a recent development in the state of California, because up until recently it was illegal per the state guide dog board regulations to have a two-week program for a first-time student that was residentially based. There weren't enough hours to actually comply. We have been able to negotiate and educate the board that many of the hours which are needed are actually occurring now before the client even gets to the residence. In the home interview process, and as I'll deal with later, some of the information and education which is provided prior to training. In terms of retrained students, both class types incorporate first-time and retrained students, with the ratios remaining 3-to-1 or 2-to-1 in terms of instructor to student, depending on the retrained class length, which continues to be 3 weeks or 2 weeks in California or solely 2 weeks in Oregon. So that's a little bit of background, and I think getting back to the main point of individualization of instruction, those of you who know or have undergone 4 weeks of training can probably remember it was a bit like boot camp, if you ask me. And I'm very pleased to say that things have changed. Things have changed radically. So, highlighting some of the key outcomes thus far which relate to service provision for people with multiple disabilities. The new class structure has been found to be more practical and flexible in order to address the individual needs and circumstances of each client, which is extremely important, as I said, to people with disabilities in addition to blindness and health challenges. The number and length of routes are adjusted for the health and fitness levels of clients. Someone who needs more rest can do so, just as very active and athletic clients can add to their workouts. And I remember the days, and this is not a good memory, that if you were a client that did have an additional disability and you needed extra time to recover, that feeling confident to take a break, to take the afternoon off, to rest, to recover, wasn't an easy thing to ask for. It was seen as you're behind. You're behind your student colleagues. Thankfully, that is no more. Teams transition at individual rates. This is nothing new. So a team can go from working under close supervision and receiving constant instructive feedback to independently negotiating the normal challenge of travel at their own rate of learning. This is another huge difference. Previous, things were very orchestrated. There was a blueprint that we, as the educators, thought would give someone the most potential of graduating our program. In other words, it was a bit like the 1960s, 70s institutionalized model. Do as we say and you will be successful, as opposed to a now more modern facilitative approach. How would you like to learn in order to be successful? Clients have the option of focusing their own work in urban, suburban, or rural travel environments, but still receive some exposure to each environment. However, it's largely unnecessary for students with additional challenges to receive training in environments that they do not utilise at home, or importantly, would find restrictive or stressful. So as a case in point, if someone utilised, say, a support cane due to an orthopaedic issue, then the last thing they may want to do is go to a foreign environment which they would never use at home. Maybe, let's just suggest, going and working a sidewalkless route if they're an urban person, just because the organisation said, well, that's part of our program, you must do it. We're very much now more, well, do you use a sidewalkless environment at home? Well, if not, what is the benefit to you? If there is none, why do it? You're better off conserving your energy and doing something which is more appropriate. We also have improved the collaboration between client and instructor. Again, using that 1960s, 1970s time period, instructors were more, you know, do as I say. I hate to use that word, but it was more, okay, follow what I have to say. Whenever you're working with an individual, you need to be collaborative and facilitative. So therefore, these meetings are designed to be sessions where there is planning going on between the instructor and the client. And it needs to be regular meetings, not when something goes wrong. Meetings to discuss successes, other ways of doing things, things that are challenging, things that are easy, and doing it a number of times. So a rapport and trust is built between the client and the instructor. This is a fundamental concept of adult learning, adult education. There should be no fear of failure in adult learning. Okay, guide dog organisations aren't primary schools, elementary schools or high schools. We're teaching adults. Therefore, it should be such that an adult feels they have the power to say whatever they want to say with no fear of retribution. So these collaborative meetings are exactly that. They're meetings of equals. I mentioned that also to help make this more of an adult learning focus, class material is provided in advance of class, so clients arrive already having some familiarity with guide dog concepts. And this is important whether it's a first-time person with an additional disability or a retrained person or any client. The more informed someone is before training commences, the more they can actually take part in the learning process rather than being captive. And those of you, again, who have heard or have done these old classes might remember the boring 4 o'clock lecture series which used to take place with a captive audience knowing little about the topic, but basically prisoners of what the instructor was going to say. It's different now in terms of you're expected to educate yourselves with the material that's made available to participate in discussion sessions, which might occur at any time of the day, not when everyone's ready for dinner at 4 o'clock and is falling asleep. Now, you can imagine they've got all these individualised programs going on, then things are different too in regard to how the class is grouped. It's likely that it will be split up for training in various environments. You could have some clients doing sidewalkless travel while others have no interest and their ambitions might be to practice going across busy intersections in preparation for returning home. So the transportation needs are often met these days using minivans rather than those humongous large class buses. Now, this might be a very small point to those people that, you know, might not have been involved with a guide dog program, but a smaller vehicle for someone who is physically challenged in particular, we've found, is a far better transportation option. Getting into one of those big, humongous class buses can be difficult. If you've got a support cane or if you are physically compromised, if you're elderly and have to conserve your energy stores. Also, we can park those minivans in more places and provide additional opportunities for productive conversations between instructor and student. It's more intimate than having everyone on the large bus. We still use the large buses, but we're much more, okay, what's best for you? Are you comfortable in the large bus or you want to go out in the small minivan? I'd like to read some comments now from two of our registered nurses who are involved with classes that serve to describe the benefits that we have seen from the perspective of an experienced medical professional. So I'm quoting here. My observation has been that students with chronic medical conditions and older students do much better when they are in their own home environment. In the past, with the four-week program, by the third week, we saw exhaustion set in and an increase in nursing needs. The two-week program has proven to be a positive environment in the overall health needs of our students. And a second commentary from another nurse. The positive aspects of the smaller three-week class, from my perspective, are the following. Better student-to-instructor ratio, hence quicker learning and less downtime. Smaller classes allow more attention by nurses when monitoring a class of 11 or 12 than a class of 20 to 24 with one registered nurse per shift. Better access to registered nurse care and assessment and less waiting time is another benefit. More time can be allotted for registered nurse teaching regarding self-care and preventative health measures. Classes seem to have less friction, possibly due to private rooms, which is another benefit of having smaller classes. Each person now has their own room. Smaller classes, more attention and shorter time spent away from home. I'd also like to read a case study which provides further evidence in support of the new class program, assisting clients specifically with additional disabilities. A determined 71-year-old woman from a small town applied for her first guide dog. She had the additional challenges of diabetes and compromised stamina, so was placed on a waiting list for an easy-to-control guide. A dog from the Oregon campus was selected for her, and the woman was scheduled for a new two-week class for first-time students. The instructor team was initially doubtful if this individual would succeed in the new two-week program, but they were determined to give her the best support they could. The instructors also anticipated that a transition visit after graduation would be necessary. Again, a bit of vocabulary. A transition visit would be something where an instructor would be required to accompany the client home or visit them shortly afterwards to provide more support, more training, more learning to help the person achieve success with their guide dog. The instructors chose to focus this woman's training on routes that combine sidewalks and sidewalkers areas in the Gresham area, which is a small town outside Boring, where we do a number of our training routes in Oregon. So focus in Gresham in an effort to replicate her home environment as closely as possible. During the first 3 days of class, the client had difficulty remembering commands and body positioning. Her poor leash handling skills led the instructor staff to question if she would ever be able to succeed with a guide dog, no matter what type of class she was enrolled in. However, during days 4 to 7, the client's training sessions were adjusted so that time with an instructor was split between practicing basic handling skills without her dog and street work with her dog. Her instructors were pleasantly surprised by the acceleration of the woman's progress after the instructional modifications. And in fact, by the end of the first week, she was basically doing the same as her other classmates. She was consistently able to complete safe and independent routes during the second week of training and, in fact, graduated without the need for any transitional assistance. This student's experience strongly influenced the instructor team's opinion regarding the new two-week class. Prior to this, and as I did, I've got to admit, you would assume this sort of client would be best served by a four-week traditional class. I mean, after all, it would give them more time, right? More time to learn, more time to rest, maybe. But after witnessing her progress firsthand, they were now convinced that this client was best served by the format of the new two-week class. In fact, they believe the demands of the old four-week class would have been too much for her. So that's a nice story how it succeeded there. So I've got about just under 10 minutes to go with some question time in there as well. So I'd just like to quickly move on to talking about another key component of servicing any client, but particularly clients with additional challenges. In order to maximise the potential benefits of this type of program, guide dog organisations throughout the world, including Guide Dogs for the Blind, should utilise a variety of instructional methods provided by a team of highly educated instructors. Since the 90s, Guide Dogs for the Blind has seen the benefits of adding orientation, mobility, theory and practice to the educations of its instructors. Many educational subjects studied within orientation and mobility master's degree programs throughout the country and the world are also vitally important for guide dog instructors to be educated about, particularly when it comes to working with people with multiple disabilities. The Guide Dogs for the Blind Apprentice Program now includes theory and practice pertaining to allied health professions such as, and these are just a few, occupational therapy, physical therapy, neurology, neuropsychology, audiology, psychology and optometry. And I can say most definitely that the Guide Dogs for the Blind Apprentice Program is a world-class program, and I say that because I was a member of the International Federation training group that was charged with the responsibility of developing an instructor curriculum which all guide dog member schools could use as a blueprint to improve the training of their apprentice and instructor staff. And Guide Dogs for the Blind were very active in that, and our program complies fully. In fact, it exceeds the basics of that blueprint curriculum put forward by the IGDF. Taking the role of O&M one step further, we value the role of O&M so much that a dual-qualified guide dog O&M specialist is part of the instructional team for every guide dog class. Many students with multiple disabilities end up receiving instruction and support from the dual-trained mobility specialist while they're in class. Instruction can involve incorporation of a support cane in guide dog travel, which I mentioned earlier, perhaps assistance with the utilisation of hearing aids while in class, to specific and specialised instruction with clients who have a neurological injury or a traumatic brain injury, for example, which makes learning and remembering more difficult. And going on, when it comes to the provision of services designed to support teams following graduation, many of our field managers, like myself, are also dual-qualified guide dog O&M specialists. So we can incorporate some of those key fundamental areas of the orientation mobility education into field services with guide dog clients, whether that be just basic orientation, but perhaps working with someone who does incorporate a support cane with their guide dog, for example, needing to judge how the dog is responding, working on safety at street crossings, for example, any number of things. The O&M qualification gives a lot of flexibility to the instructor and, of course, the client's benefiting by that. And lastly, I'd like to mention two things. Jean mentioned to me in preparation for the presentation that there was some interest in our wheelchair training program. So just very quickly, based at our Oregon campus, we train guide dogs to work with people who utilise power wheelchairs for their mobility, so not manual chairs at this stage. Training programs are conducted in the student's home environment by specially trained instructor staff. Clients must already be independent in the use of the powered chair, but we do have a wheelchair program. And the last thing I'd like to mention before I open things up for questions is we have established a new GDB alumni chapter called the Guide Dog Handlers Always chapter, emphasis A-L-L-W-A-Y-S chapter. Members of this chapter have a disability in addition to visual impairment and can offer support and advice for members, applicants, graduates, staff, and all manner of various interested people or groups. So I think that's a terrific development at Guide Dogs for the Blind. So thank you for your attention, but do I have time to open it for questions? Yeah.
So we have time for two questions. And we have two. All right.
Mark, I was wondering if you could just go in a little more about how the person using an electric wheelchair uses the guide dog for their guidance independently.
Sure. Well, first of all, the dogs for the wheelchair program are very carefully selected and trained. There is a different training program for those dogs, a lot of similarities to the usual one, of course, but there's additional training. The handle that attaches to the guide dog is a little longer than usual because of the fact that clearly we have a safety need there to prevent the dog contacting the chair and to allow the person in the chair more reaction time in terms of manipulating the chair and preparing for directional changes. The training is in-home, which I mentioned, and there's a very key reason for that, that because of the potential of some safety concerns, if we were to take a person out of a familiar environment, which they were oriented to and knew some of the risks, such as slopes at wheelchair ramps, sizes of doorways, the way doors open in or out, those sorts of things, it would be very difficult to have them learning to work with a new wheelchair-trained dog in a novel environment. So putting them in the home environment where they're already oriented, we can then have them bringing that education and knowledge to the new dog and pattern the new dog appropriately in that on those routes and in that environment which the person is going to use. So it's a very specific program, Gene. I am not one of those specially trained instructors. I wish I was, but that's probably as much as I could tell you in the short time that I have.
Thank you.
Yes, this is Jeff Tom, and I'm going to use a caveat here because my wife has physical disabilities, and she has never had an issue at all with GDB in this area. But having said that, we have heard some concerns about some incidents with people with physical disabilities that perhaps, and I don't want to get into any particular incidents, but that there may not be standardization in terms of the evaluation that is done to determine whether someone should or is, qualified to get a dog. Can you address that at all?
That's a great question. You know, one of the points that I think any guide dog organization needs to constantly improve is, as you're saying, it's difficult to standardize, but it's also important to have your assessment staff, first of all, the people out there conducting a practical assessment, as knowledgeable as possible about the individuals they're assessing. Not all of our staff, for example, are cross-trained in terms of dual qualified, which I think gives a distinct advantage to the assessment process. We have staff at different levels of experience. We have apprentices, we have young instructors, we have senior instructors conducting these home interviews. And no matter how you do it, you are going to have a learning process in terms of the amount of home interviews someone does in terms of developing a skill and the ability to look at an individual and think, yes, I think this person could be successful. So that's always going to be there no matter how thorough your training program. But then there's a next phase, which I think is extremely important, that at our organisation, no matter how experienced you are, as an assessing or a home interviewing instructor, you can't say, yes, I'm going to accept you. Your information is then gathered and put forward to the applicant review committee, which are the people at the school charged with the responsibility through their experience of making sound decisions about someone's candidacy. And I would like to think that those individuals are taking the information gathered and making fair and neutral decisions. And I should also point out that I believe any reputable guide dog organisation and the IGDF do have standards to make sure this is in place with member schools, of which not all American schools are, that there is an appeals or grievance procedure in place to allow an applicant who has been denied to appeal that decision without any fear of retribution and with complete neutrality from the organisation. We do have that at Guide Dogs for the Blind. I'm not a member of the committee, the ARC, but I am familiar with telling clients that have been denied that you have the right of appeal, and that is extremely important to tell a client.
Thank you very much. And I'm sorry we can only take those two questions, but this was a very informative presentation. Thank you for giving your time today.
Thank you.
And we definitely had a number of people listening from other states. We had New York check in and Florida check in, and so we're getting some good listening on our streaming. All right, everyone, we will go ahead and end this session and hope to see. actually, we're pretty late for our committee meetings and such, and we have the president's dinner, so we'll have more door prizes tonight. Take care. Thank you.